Hey listeners, it's your host, Aisha. Happy Labor Day, the ironically named American holiday whereon many of us don't work, including the classical classroom staff. And so we are bringing you a kick-ass rerun featuring the inimitable American composer, musician, and innovator, Daniel Bernard Rumain, also known as DBR. You're going to love this episode or your money back. Also, drumroll, we have a new thing just in time for the new semester. It's a weekly pop quiz. If you want to play along, just follow us on Twitter or Tumblr. Then every Monday when we release our latest episode, we're going to tweet and tumble 5 episode-related questions. People who email me with the correct answers at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org will have their names put into a sweaty hat. They'll then be swirled around, and with his eyes closed, producer Todd will then pick a winner. For winning, you will receive an incredible prize, 1 random artifact of my choosing, which will be delivered to you via U.S. mail, and we'll say your name on the show. So, follow us on Twitter and Tumblr to play along, and email me correct answers at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org, and may the odds be ever in your favor. Also, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us on iTunes. Okay, enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the classical classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today, in a TV studio, because that's where you do radio, is Daniel Bernard Rumain. Daniel is a composer and a performer. He's in Houston because he's actually working with the Aura Contemporary Music Ensemble to do a show called Range of Motion. Daniel has collaborated with everybody from Philip Glass to Lady Gaga, which I'd say is a pretty wide range.
A little bit.
Welcome to the show, Daniel. What are you going to be teaching me about today?
We're going to talk about taking something and making it your own.
Okay.
Appropriation. Property.
Okay.
Taking the and making it my.
Okay.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And yes, when I was 5 years old, I started playing the violin. And my good Haitian mother, as she would often remind me, is when you enter someone's home or radio station space, you bring a gift. And my gift today is the notion of sharing and the world of ideas and the limitless possibilities of not just my imagination, but of course, it's your imagination, our imagination. So I started playing the violin when I was 5 years old, small town called Margate, Florida. It wasn't Pompano Beach, it wasn't Fort Lauderdale, it wasn't Miami. Those places are cool. It wasn't Houston. Houston's cool.
Arguably so.
Yeah. Before it's hot, it's cool. And Margate was none of those things. And by cool, I mean real. And by real, I mean relevant. And by relevant, I mean a relationship. When I started playing the violin, I wanted the violin to be cool, but it wasn't. Drums was cool. Guitar, cool. Flute, cool. Even breathing seemed to be cool. But the violin was not cool. So I had to find a way to make the violin cool.
Okay, so if you wanted a cool instrument,
yeah,
why'd you pick the uncool instrument?
Well, sometimes instruments choose you.
Okay.
And there was something about the look of the violin, the sound of it.
Picturing a Harry Potter situation,
yes,
the
exactly.
Violin floating toward you.
Yeah, you know, kind of. When you're 5 years old and you're walking down the hallway and you look to your right and there's a music room full of second, third, fourth, fifth graders all playing different instruments. The violin stood out, but it was, maybe it was not only the violin, but it was the magic of music making. They were all doing this thing together. And I remember I broke rank, you know, you're holding hands, walking a yellow line, I'm sure. And I walked into that classroom and there were a bunch of kids, children, playing the violin. And I just thought it was so cool. I wanted to do it too. It was simple as that.
Yeah. And that's how you two met. Where did it go from there?
Well, I always say I'm a composer because I was more afraid not to be.
Okay.
So I knew early on. I knew by 6 years old I wanted to make music my life. And I suppose somewhere in there make my living as a musician. Mm-hmm. I suppose. You know, you're 6 years old, you're not quite thinking that way. I suppose, you know, it was going to be all...
You're very mature.
Yeah, very mature. But, you know, I did middle school. I remember, you know, in a garage, band with friends, and I would not tell anybody I played the violin because it was not cool. But I think somebody saw the case, you know.
What is that tiny
what
guitar?
What is that thing? And I was kicking it away. Oh, sorry. And, you know, after I kind of told them, it's funny, you know, the first time I played for my garage band friends, they were totally into it. They had no idea I was in the orchestra. Yeah. To them, it was cool. And I remember we kind of retrofitted one of my violins with a guitar pickup so we could plug it in. Because louder was better, mm-hmm. you know. So that was a big leap. And then, starting to play electronic violins and plugging into computers and just using computers as more of as a musical instrument and tool.
Mm-hmm.
That started in high school.
So you have all of these very eclectic sounds going through your young head. And so there you are with this instrument. And you're like, how can I put this there?
Right. Yeah, how can I turn the violin into my violin? And there's a really big difference. And my violin, because my parents were Haitian and Spanish and French, and because I was in South Florida, a melting pot of different cultures and ideas and musics. My violin became very potent. You know, I could turn my violin into a drum kit. I could turn my violin into a DJ. You know, what could a DJ teach me about playing the violin? I could turn my violin into a guitar, you know? That's using your fingernail. It's a whole different technique that they're not going to teach you in the academy.
I find it so interesting. I mean, clearly you've studied music and you've been taught all of the things that one is supposed to do with a violin.
Supposed to do, that's right. I like the way you said that because that implies something else.
Yeah, but like, what was it for you that made you go, you know, screw that? I'm going to do this other thing. Like, what happened for you?
Yeah, that's a really big question. It was the 1970s, you know, I'm in my 40s, so it was the 1970s. In some ways, the world was a dangerous place,
mm-hmm.
you know, not in the way that it is now, you know, kids getting stabbed in schools, and that's something else.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different kind of danger. What I do remember was being precocious, being daring, and a culture in which teachers celebrated that.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoyed the challenge. And even in my little elementary school orchestra, but certainly in my middle school and high school classroom, you know, teachers back then, where I'm from, they really wanted you to not be part of the crowd or part of the
mm-hmm.
fabric. So that was a big part of it. And then the other part was the execution. I mean, garage band back in the 70s meant your friends in a garage.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
If the drum kit player didn't show up the day or he was sick or grounded or whatever, you played drum kit.
Yeah.
So I learned drum kit. Keyboard, you learn keyboard. If the singer didn't show up, well, you're going to sing and make up the words.
Mm-hmm. I think I might be just a few years younger than you, but I also belong to...
You look many, many years.
You, sir, may come back all the time.
You look half my age.
No, I grew up in the 80s. I mean, like, that's...
Yeah.
You know. When I was a kid, I could say the same thing. And there's something about our generation that like we had that mixture of living in a very, you know, sort of analog, kind of simple world. We wrote letters, you know.
It's true.
We didn't have cell phones, you know.
That's right.
And then that technology came along when we were sort of young enough to embrace it,
right,
but old enough to, for lack of a better way to put it, to know better.
Sure, sure.
You know, like I think we've had like an equal dose of both. I think that makes for a really interesting experience.
Yeah, we can remember the time before the internet.
Yeah,
and before
exactly.
Before text and before, absolutely. And, but you know, I wanted to go back to something you were hitting on, this notion of allowance. Mm. I mean, I think that, there, you know, I keep saying this, and one day I'm going to have to actually do the work. There is probably a study or studies where there is a direct relation between the rise of violence in our schools and the lowering of arts offerings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really do think that. And there's something insidious,
yes,
about how much control and how much testing. And, you know, it is a very dangerous – you could die in your classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not hyperbole. That's not just a saying. You know,
yeah,
school can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the safest place on earth anymore. And I didn't grow up with that threat.
Right.
Not at all.
Me either.
And I do wonder, statistically speaking, and this is related, you know, as a young black boy, I'm not supposed to have a violin in my hand.
Yeah, what are you doing?
You know, and, you know, there's a lot of other things that are supposed to have kind of been a part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say playing the violin changed my life and saved my life, statistically speaking, for a young black man in this country, a relatively young black person in this country, that's a very real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of my energy and my wants and my needs and my pain went into what I call my weapon of choice, you know, my violin.
Yeah.
And really making, you know, I had teachers and I had parents and I was lucky enough to have people around me that supported and celebrated tearing this instrument apart,
mm-hmm,
you know, with and that's not always the case anymore, you know.
Yeah, I think that's something that I've come to be very aware of doing the show, is just how those sorts of programs are being, just they're the first things to go.
Yeah,
and I can't believe it. Art, creativity, music—they're
yeah,
not things that you can easily put a number on.
Exactly.
But they're immeasurably important.
That's
no
right.
matter what you grow up to become, you know, if you grow up to become an accountant, like, you need that part of
That's
yourself
right.
to
right.
be able to grow and to have the experience that you did, where
yeah,
you got to get to a point where you were just like, you looked at a musical instrument that you were taught to play one way and went, no, I think I'm going to do it a different way.
Yeah.
And like be able to approach the world in that way. And you only get to do that in art class and in music. You
yeah,
get to do that in math.
Yeah.
I guess maybe some people do if they're super smart, but
yeah,
I do not get to do that in math.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, for me, if you go back to Margate, Florida right now, Margate Elementary School, you cannot play the violin. Those instruments are gone. There's no music program. And I would say, you know, this is a kind of an educational show in a lot of ways. I'm here to learn from you. I'm here to learn from this light. You know, this microphone has a story to tell. You know, I look at everything as potential.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was a teacher in that situation, I think that I would probably have an orchestra made up of iPhones and iPads. Let's make music. You know, and if you don't have iPhones and iPads, then let's put our hands together. Let's make
pencils.
Music. Exactly.
Spirals.
A narrative chorus.
Yeah.
You know, open a book and let's say these words together, but in a hyper-rhythmic way.
You know? Should be doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and that's
this
what I'm getting.
This is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this. I go all around the world, and I can tell you, especially in this country, there's just less music happening in our schools,
mm-hmm,
period. But that doesn't mean that there's less imagination. That doesn't mean that there's less opportunity. You just got to solve the problem in a
right,
hyper-creative way. So, yeah, there's one thing that is pervasive. Young people have big ideas about themselves and the world, not as it is, but as it should be.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I've done this where I've had students, young people, take out their phones, take out their computers, take out their iPads, take out their car keys, take out anything that makes a sound, and we become what I call an orchestra of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's what you've got to do, because once the imagination goes away, I call it an imagination muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Once you stop flexing that, and once you stop applying that muscle to
yeah,
every day of your life, it becomes kind of calcified and hard, and you become a hard, rigid person.
Yeah, I think being able to have creative vision, you know, it allows you not only to be able to make art and to make music and to do all of those kinds of things, but to look at your reality in a different way, to step outside of the sort of, I don't know, workaday life and maybe breathe a little bit of something else into your world, to see it in a different way.
You're right. You can look at the world differently, and then you can apply it in a different perspective. I mean, my first music teacher was Mr. Miller. He was probably in his 60s. He was Jewish. The first tune I ever learned publicly was HaTikvah. You know, I was 5 years old, had a big afro. I didn't know where Israel was. But HaTikvah meant everything, because it meant everything to Mr. Miller.
Yeah.
Years later, I'm living in Harlem. Miss Logan, she's in her 80s. She knew Ralph Ellison. She lived through the Harlem Renaissance. Big black woman with these big fake eyelashes, smoking Marlboro cigarettes every day. She had quite the voice. And she, you know, to me, this would be Miss Logan. Smoky, smoky.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to say, you know, anyone I meet, I take a little bit of them and they end up at the tips of my fingers, and then I can talk about them and really give you a musical portrait of who they are, which in some ways can be more powerful than any other kind of portrait.
I love that idea. And I also love that, like, I realized while you were talking that, you know, when you're a kid, that's something that's really easy to do, to look at something and see it as something else. Like, my grandma would give us boxes and some sheets, and we were like, spaceship.
Right.
You know?
I love that.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, and bringing that sort of childlike sensibility into the adult world and doing something like what you're doing now. I think that's fantastic, being able to see something than other than what you're told that it is.
Exactly. Exactly.
Love it.
It's an appropriation. It's borrowing from other cultures, other styles, other sounds, and making it your own.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. In a lot of ways, I try to make the violin not sound like a violin.
Uh-huh.
It's wood. You know, I call it my wood box.
Your
it's really
wood
what
box.
It is. Yeah, it is. You know, my wood box, it is a vibrating box of wood and steel and carbon fiber. And when you start to approach an instrument from an imaginative perspective, then the possibilities are endless. The sonic, the sonic vision, as you say, that sonic vision and it's and a sonic landscape becomes boundless.
Who kind of populated your sonic vision? Like who was there for you?
Well, that was the problem. You know, growing up, my father and my mother had big musical tastes and ideas. So there was Beethoven and Mozart in the house, and Mahler and Brahms. But there was also the Jackson Five and Prince and Barry White. And somewhere in there, believe it or not, John Cage snuck in. You know, yeah. And my father had these wild albums, Stockhausen and Cage and even Penderecki, the soundtrack to The Exorcist, which is actually a string quartet by George Crumb. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there's a big lawsuit about that, too, because he didn't give permission for that music to be itself. That's another story. We're both University of Michigan grads. That's the only reason
I
know it. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, my father's record collection was my kind of library of Alexandria, in a way. There was a little bit of everything in there. But I remember that John Cage record, because I remember the expectation of, you know, wanting to hear piano or expecting something, and it was prepared piano, and the sounds were so radical. The sounds were so different. This is an important part of classical music's tradition, this notion of idiomatic creation, idiomatic writing. mm-hmm. something that can only be played on a certain instrument.
Okay.
And this led to many composers, John Cage, Henry Cowell, Earl Brown, preparing the instruments, meaning adding things to the instruments, applying different techniques to the instruments to make them, well, in some ways, not sound like the instrument. John Cage and his prepared piano. He's sticking screws and bolts, and he's doing other things to the piano to give it a much different sound. It sounds like a gamelan orchestra at times. It becomes something other than just piano.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can hear that he stuck screws in there,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, a piano, one key might have three strings on it. So you can stick screws in between, it turns it. You can also hear he's put chains or something on top of the strings, which gives it a almost like a harpsichord type of sound. Yeah. So it sounds like a piano, but also something else is happening there.
Right.
It's really great. So I've always, you know, as we were saying, and I think this is a big, actually, that piece is probably from the 50s or the 60s. But the relevancy of that notion to 2014, I think, is that we literally want to put our fingerprints on stamps on everything that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, taking the notion of preparing a piano, because John Cage wanted to make the piano his own,
mm-hmm.
and applying that to the violin, I feel that in many ways I'm preparing the violin, but more than that, I am making the violin into my violin, my signature sound. The violin was often about things that they were trying to teach me, like a scale. But my violin could turn that scale, you know, into magic. And it was more than that, you know. The violin was about pizzicato. But my violin was about bass. The violin was about vibrato. My violin, though, was about wild vibrato. You know, it's all really making it hyper personal. So every day, I'm trying to find ways even to make a wood box breathe. You know, trying to make my violin cry, laugh, make it sing. trying to make my violin into a flute. You know, trying to make my violin into some sort of machine.
So, when I hear your stuff, I hear all of these other genres of music coming in. Clearly, I'm hearing guitar solos.
Yeah.
You know, I'm hearing some bluegrass. I'm hearing all kinds of stuff in there. So, talk a little bit about where your sonic vision met the violin.
Right.
And how you married those two things.
Nashville, actually Vanderbilt was big because there are so many great musicians in Nashville, not just country, I mean all types of music. Mm-hmm. Every day in Nashville there are recording sessions all over that town. It really is Music City, USA. And then going to the University of Michigan, which is this massive college town where there's a real intellectual rigor and, you know, a music school with probably 2,000 students. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite of kind of this small 15,000 Vanderbilt University school in the South, going to a campus that had well over 100,000 students and actually ran that. Ann Arbor. Yeah, it was, you know, cold as well, you know. And then, and certainly Ann Arbor got me to New York City, you know, in a lot of ways. I was prepared. And Harlem at the time in 1998 was much different than it is today. It was dangerous. Mm-hmm. It was ungentrified in a way. And it was full of black people. And if you can think of Nashville, Ann Arbor,
Not so full of the black people. Nashville,
pretty vanilla. Nothing wrong with that. You know, being in Harlem in New York City, mm-hmm. being in Harlem in New York City at that time. It was kind of, I got there right before the big change happened. Because now Harlem is still black, but it's more than that.
Yeah.
Well, New York City's always changing, but Harlem in 2014 is not the Harlem that it was in 1998. Mm-hmm. And so I got there just as the changes were happening, but the ghosts were still there and the rhythms of the street were still there and the echoes of Harlem's Renaissance were still there.
Yeah.
And I was able to really absorb all that. Yeah, so I think from John Cage to you and I, mm-hmm. that would be my lesson of the day, that your imagination can claim any tradition, any idea, and you can make it your own. And that's actually what you're supposed to do.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
This has been inspiring. I'm inspired.
I'm inspired.
I think our listeners are going to be too. It's very, very
cool. I hope so too.
All right, everybody, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. You can hear more Classical Classroom on our website at houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom, where, by the way, this week, we actually have some video enhancement for the podcast. You can go there and see video of Daniel Romain performing a couple of different songs in our TV studio. You can also see a video recording of this episode of the show, which will be super exciting watching us sit in front of microphones. Thanks to the University of Houston Cynthia Woods Mitchell Center for the Arts, where Daniel Bernard Romain is an artist in residence, to DBR for being here on the show, to our producer Todd T-Dog Hulslander for twiddling knobs, to our program director Sinjin Flynn for providing spiritual oversight. Many thanks also to Daniel Webben for his production assistance on this episode, and to Troy Schultz for producing the video, to me for saying words, and to you for listening. Thanks, and we'll catch you next time.